Blog Talk Radio.
Happy New Year, folks. I hope all of you are doing well. We've taken some time off here at Carson's Corner, the MMA edition, but now we're back with a bang and set to feature MMA filmmaker Ed Doty. Before we get to the rest of the show, though, I want to send our condolences to the family of Mauricio Zingano following his death. We were all shocked by this, and like all suicides, this is a sad story, and I can only imagine what Kat and her son are going through at the moment. Mauricio struck me at times as quite highly strung, though. I remember some of his comments during exchanges with Brian Caraway and Misha Tate, and it seemed as if he was really taking things personally. And, of course, you know, a lot of people get stressed out. I know that Zingano and Tate were having something of a feud at the time, and this is, you know, an era where everyone wanted to take shots at Misha, but for some reason it stuck out seeing him on Twitter responding angrily to different accounts, especially when people said something negative or suggestive about Kat. And our former guest, Keith Sutton, who's a friend of the show, is also an associate of Mauricio, said that he could tell that something was wrong in just the last few months from the tone of Zingano's social media posts. But whatever the reason is, it does appear to be a fact that he withdrew from some aspects of his public life over the last 6 months. Let me read a tweet from Mauricio that was dated to July of this year. Back then, he was talking about Kat every day, and he wrote, "The only thing certain in life is death. You don't know when it will arrive, but you know it will. Hug the one you love and never let them go." And I'm not sure what might have happened between now and then, but something seems to have changed. And I know a lot of people have been critical of Mauricio for apparently taking his own life, and I understand the position that suicide is a selfless act. There's no question about that, but you can't properly know what a person is going through when you haven't lived their life. Mental illness can often be a factor. Often people feel that there's nothing left to live for. They make decisions that seem completely irrational to the rest of us, and most people can't even imagine wanting to be dead, because the majority of us constantly fear death, so feeling the opposite way must be truly terrible. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more about this story in the coming weeks and months, and I'm hopeful that the coverage of some of these MMA sites are respectful. Generally, that's the case when something like this happens, but the growth of the sport has meant that a lot of other media outlets can cover this. My main concern is that things not get any worse for Kat and her son right now. People should really respect their privacy and let them deal with these tragic events at their own accord. So we'll see. So all the best for Kat and her son, Braden. Kat seems like a really, really good person. Without further ado, we're going to come back to some more commentary a little later on. But without further ado, we are pleased to welcome filmmaker and old school fan Ed Doty to the show. Ed, welcome to Carson's Corner.
How are you doing, sir? Thank you for having me.
Good. Thank you for coming on the show. We're very excited about this. I know you've got a new movie project coming up, but first, I wanted to give folks at home a feel for how you got interested in the sport as well as the art of filmmaking, because my understanding is that you were a film student when you first started to record things related to MMA, and I assume that film was your first interest of the two. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mention that, because it's really hard for me to sort of separate my love for film and my passion for filmmaking and my love for martial arts. They both sort of started around the same time. I started in traditional martial arts when I was about 14, and right around that time was when my father and I started My father was a huge film buff, and he and I had like a weekly film club that we used to do, and he used to show me all sorts of films. So they kind of started together, and part of the way he got me into films in general was he started by showing me old kung fu movies and old samurai movies. So like I said, it's hard for me to separate my love for the two. And I ordered, as soon as the UFC kind of came out, I remember just being fascinated with it. I ordered a UFC 3, I think, live on pay-per-view when I was like 16, I think, at the time. And I've been a fan ever since. In terms of filming MMA, I was at, in 1999, I was at a kind of an underground, not technically legal event promoted by my friend Bobby Rozek at the Hollywood Athletic Club right here in Hollywood. And I went, and it was great. I was training with Jean-Jacques Machado at the time. And so we had a few people who were sort of friendly to our school fighting on the same card. Larry Landless, I think, was the ref. Daryl Golar fought on the card, if I remember correctly. And towards the end of it, there was a bad call, a bad decision, and a near riot kind of broke out. Like, there were glass bottles being thrown in the cage. But at the same time, there was this electric feel in the air that I had never experienced at any other sort of live event. And being close to the sport and close to the community, you know, really all my teenage years and into my adult life at that point, I knew that there was nothing really like it. And that was the first idea I got. Okay, you know, maybe for one of my student projects I can do something about this sport. And so later that year, in 1999, I needed a 10-minute piece for one of my classes. I needed like a 10-minute short. And so I was the only kid in my class to do a documentary. And I went down to a Neutral Grounds / IFC co-promoted event at the Barona Indian Reservation down in like North County, San Diego. Because at the time, you know, everything was, there was no regulation. Indian land was pretty much Native American land was the only area that you could technically legally promote fights that were full Vale Tudo or NHB at the time. And so that was the first event, and that was where, and some of the people who ended up being in my first home life in the cage were people I met. So Eddie Millis I met that night. I met Vernon Tiger White that night. I met Jeremy Horn. He was fighting in the main event against John Marsh. Adrian Serrano, a couple of UFC vets. You know, there were Monty Cox I met that night. Bob Shamrock I think I met that night. So that was, I filmed that, cut a 10-minute piece, and then over the Christmas break I realized, you know, I think I have something here that's more than just a student film. So I wrote up a proposal to my college, and I said, okay, I want to do an independent study, and the independent study is me making a feature-length documentary or close to feature-length. And they basically just gave me gear and access to the editor room, and they said, go for it. And the byproduct of that became this film called Life in the Cage, which got a little bit of distribution through Brentwood Communications. It was the same company that distributed all of King of the Cage's stuff. And so, therefore, it just became this great working relationship with Terry Shrovelcock and Bud Brutzman, filming a lot of events, of their events. And then that became sort of the bulk of my film.
In terms of your filmmaking outlook and approach, who and what would you say are some of your main influences? I mean, do you look favorably on any directors and features specifically?
Absolutely. I do a couple podcasts myself, and one of them is a documentary-centric podcast. And for me, documentaries kind of begin and end with Errol Morris. He's been one of my favorite filmmakers, not just documentary filmmakers, but just filmmakers, period. I love his approach to interviewing. I studied him greatly, read articles about him, and that informed quite a bit of, you know, sort of how I approach it. I also, you know, a really big pivotal one for me was Dogtown and Z-Boys by Stacy Peralta, which was a documentary about the 1970s, you know, skateboarding scene in Southern California. Beyond that, Werner Herzog, always great. Mm-hmm. I like Kirby Dick a lot. I like Kirby Dick's earlier stuff. Kirby Dick is most famous these days for The Invisible War and for the film was not yet rated. But a lot of his earlier stuff, like Chain Camera and Twist of Faith, I was a really big fan of. I like that even when he's doing a documentary about there's a lot of information to get across, and it seems kind of procedural and more of a process. He's still able to add like the right amount of kind of what we call verite footage or reality footage, which is just people interacting in their normal environment. So I like his approach a great deal. This year, I actually saw a movie called The Act of Killing that completely knocked me on my ass. I'm calling it now. That's going to win the Oscar for Best Documentary by a handy margin. There's never been a film like that. So I talked that one up as much as I possibly can. And then D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus, they did the War Room, the very famous 92 campaign documentary. I'm big fans of theirs as well.
Now, let's go back. When you were at this event and you met all these pivotal figures in the world of MMA, you were already in film school, or were you thinking about it when you first became aware of the event?
Say that again. Sorry, you cut out just a little bit there.
I'm sorry. When you went to this event where you met all those fighters and people within the industry you were talking about, were you attending film school at that time?
I mean, yes. It wasn't like a postgraduate film school. I was a film major at a college in Southern California called California Lutheran University. But yeah, I'm as a film major. My degree technically is in communications with an emphasis in film and media production. But yeah, it was for school. It had its birth sort of as a school project. So.
Did any particular incidents or events seal the deal for you in terms of wanting to document what you saw both inside and outside the cage?
Well, you know, like when I was at that first event, which was promoted by my buddy, I there was such a camaraderie and a spirit mm-hmm. to it that was sort of intangible. It was just, you know, the sport was very much, for those who were around back then, they know, and for those who weren't, I mean, we were barely hanging on for a long time. To be a fan of mixed martial arts in the late 90s, it was work. You had to work. And
yes.
Not only that, everybody had to – there wasn't any money. It's almost like there was like a finite amount of money that we're all just sort of cycling through each other. You know, you pay for a ticket, which would go to promote an event, and these people would – you know, the fighters would earn a small purse, which they would use to train, which, you know, supported the trainers. I mean, so it wasn't like nobody was getting rich. We were all just sort of essentially exchanging the same money in just the various ways that we consumed the product. But we support each other as much as we could. If you wanted to watch, I joke with Josh Gross, I think, because he and I were, without knowing each other at the time, he and I both used to go to the Yankee Doodles in Marina Del Rey because it was the only place that in LA that we knew of that showed the UFC. So mm-hmm. there was like literally the only, it's not like you have the UFC sports bar app where you can just find one 5 minutes from you. You know, you had to plan. Or you knew the one guy. We used to go to Eddie Bravo's house when it was on DirecTV. And before that, we used to go to Ricky Rocket's house because he was the only guy who could, you know, get it off of satellite. So, there was definitely this spirit, which was, you know, nobody was doing it for money. We just did it because we loved it. And in my very first interview with Jeremy Horn, he said, he's like, I'm very lucky. I get to make my living fighting. He's like, if I didn't make a living fighting, I'd work, but I would still fight. I just wouldn't depend on fighting for money. It's like, now I have to fight. If you look at Jeremy Horn's record, it's ridiculous. It's like 120 and
yeah.
something. Because he had to fight to make a living. He was one of the few guys who could do this for a living in the late 90s.
You know, a lot of what you're saying.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, a lot of what you're saying really resonates with me because I was involved with the sport back at during this time period, and I was over on the East Coast, and I can attest to the underground nature of the sport itself. I mean, I live close to Atlantic City, so I can go down and watch some of the SCG events, which of course was the company that owned the UFC, but training in MMA was nearly impossible at that time. I mean, I had to travel.
It was tough.
Yeah, I had to travel about an hour north to train at a shoot fighting academy because there was no schools offering even jiu-jitsus at that time.
Sure. I think we're a little spoiled being in Southern California because for whatever reason, a lot of Brazilian sort of, I mean, obviously we had Hoisson and Horan here in the Torrance school. But because of that, I think when a lot of other Brazilians emigrated to America to teach, they're like, well, where's Hoisson at? Okay, well, and, you know, the temperature here is very kind. So, you know, we were very blessed with that. I ended up, after I graduated high school, we moved to the San Fernando Valley. And, you know, I looked up Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I was very fortunate to find Joey Doc Machado over in Tarzana here. And because the sport was so small back then, the community was so small, because if you went to one school, and you probably attest to this, even though you had to drive a ways to get there, everybody sort of congregated together. So I would literally go in, mm-hmm. and then one day I'd see Danny Inasano, or you know, John Will, who's like one of the big Australian black belts right now, or you know, for quite a while actually, he was one of Jean-Jacques' first black belts. So you know, we'd see each other. You would see just sort of these huge names nowadays, but that's because there weren't so many of us. You know, we would just happen to see somebody. So I was a little lucky in that sense. And then I did my freshman year in Hawaii. So I went to Chaminade University of Hawaii. So I was also fortunate that way because we had the Inoue brothers, and you know, we had Helson Gracie. I trained with this guy Joao. I forget his last name, but he was a brown belt under the Machados. And Homolo, who I think was a Hickson black belt. I trained with them a little bit down at the University of Hawaii. So I was lucky in that sense that between Hawaii and Los Angeles, I always had good places to train.
Let's talk about life in the cage, along with Bobby Razak, who,
sure.
You know, his rites of passage in the movie Choke with Hicks and Gracie. Life in
sure.
the Cage is really one of the first MMA documentaries and certainly one of the best. We recently had Bobby on the show, and it was a very interesting interview. Bobby is really motivated, you know, and everything he does, he really works very hard at it. Yeah, he is. He's a great guy.
He hustles, man. He busts his ass, and I can't say enough good things about him. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And newer fans might not may not appreciate this, but at the time when we were all starving for MMA content, everyone saw, you know, which came out, Life in the Cage, was really no different. People were showing it to their friends, copying it, putting it on the internet and everything else. It really seemed to be very well received.
Well, I appreciate that. I kind of have a love-hate relationship with it because on the one hand, I do feel like I really captured something that will never exist again in one sense. But on the other hand, you know, I'm my own worst critic. And just from a production value standpoint, I cringe at the awful lighting and the crappy camera. And just, you know, I'm a great editor, a good filmmaker, and a horrible cameraman. So, I have many skills. Camera operation is not one of them, but when you're making a film on your own and you can't afford crew, that's the situation you find yourself in a lot of times. So, I very much appreciate the comments. So I hear that periodically on forums like the Underground and stuff, and it's always nice to hear, but it's not something I revisit terribly often.
Do you have any plans to make Life in the Cage available for people to check it out? I'm not sure how rights and such work, but it seems like uploading it to YouTube or something like that may really draw a lot of attention your way.
Well, somebody did upload it to YouTube in chunks, but like in really poor quality. The rights, I do own it again. My deal that I signed in 2000 was a licensing deal and Brentwood had a 7-year hold on it. So in 2007, the rights reverted back to me. So I guess I could, but for the reasons why I said, for whatever reason, never occurred to me to upload it to YouTube. But I may just do that at this point.
Well, I like to watch it because, you know, we can have you on for a separate interview and we could talk in depth about it. I mean, that's a whole interview worth of questions right there, and it's very, very important. I love MMA documentaries. And I know that since Life in the Cage, you've been working on various TV projects, often as an editor, according to IMDb.
Yeah. If you look at my editor, my IMDb page, yes, you see that I got to edit the 3 seasons of Flavor of Love and amongst other shows. No, I make my living as an editor. Editing is it's where a lot of my strengths align, and documentary filmmaking and non-narrative, you know, television, a huge chunk of that is in post-production, is in the editing. So that's it's something that I enjoy doing. It's something I love doing, and that's where a lot of the work is. So not every single show I've ever worked on has aligned with my interests, but periodically I get to work on something that I really, really love. I got to work on the Bellator Fightmaster show this year, which was a lot of fun, really good group of people. Same company that did The Amazing Race, and I had worked on The Amazing Race a few years prior. I got to produce Shark Fights for Fuel prior to UFC. Prior to UFC, getting on Fox, Fuel was kind of dipping their toe in the water, so it was a great opportunity. I got to work with Eric Apple and Bill Goldberg, and those guys are great. So that was a lot of fun. And then once in a blue moon, I get to do MMA stuff or just stuff that really sort of is stuff that I would watch. Yeah, I mean, it's been a good career. I certainly, you know, my resume is certainly full. And my MDB page, I don't even think has everything I've ever worked on. I've got more stuff on my resume. But,
yeah, that's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say that you've stepped away from making your own films for a while, or is it a case that you've just been working on an array of personal stuff kind of incrementally over the last few years?
Well, when it comes to MMA filmmaking specifically, I did Life in the Cage. You know, when I work on something, it's because if I work on something on my own that isn't to support myself or my family, it's because, you know, or specifically a documentary, it's because I have questions that I want answered. I want to know. So the process of me making a film is a process of answering those questions. When I did Life in the Cage, I knew a lot about the sport, but I also knew that there was stuff I wanted to know. Doing Life in the Cage kind of got that out of my system in a lot of ways. And so after that, I was helping with my friend's feature. I worked on this kind of, it was a show called Starting Over for NBC. It was just about kind of women starting their lives over. But what was unique about it was that it was 5 hours. It was an hour a day for 5 days a week for a year straight. So that kept me busy. And that was a unique opportunity to work in a reality show that turns that around that fast. There's never been anything like that. So that was a big step. And then there's been a lot of stuff that has almost gone and hasn't. There are shows I've tried to sell. We almost sold a couple of my shows to various networks, and, you know, the Hollywood very much is like that. But in terms of my own films, yeah, I mean, it's, I have scripts. I have, I worked on a sketch comedy show for a bit, but nothing that really kind of got off the ground. And I always said I wouldn't return to MMA filmmaking unless I had legit questions that I needed answered, or I didn't want to do what everybody else is doing. I didn't want to do highlights. I didn't want to do another documentary that was essentially, hey, these guys are great, you shouldn't think bad about them, which is kind of what Life in the Cage was. Because those exist, you know, that marketplace is filled. And I didn't want to, you know, it's a huge investment to make of not just money, but just time and energy and your life. And when I do a film of my own, I know no other speed than 100%. So for me, it's like I didn't want to invest in that unless I felt like I had something to say. And also a film that wasn't just an MMA film, but just a good film that happened to be about MMA. So for me, I had to wait for kind of the right time, the right opportunity for it to happen.
Let's talk about your new project, the documentary on the former MMA personality, Rafael Torre. I want to mention right up front that you're, I think your crowdfunding route for this project, you're trying to go that route, which is an interesting model. But let's give out the URL as many times as possible so people know where to go. There's also a lot of information on the site, so you can read along during the interview if you want. It's www.indiegogo.com/project/fighting-in-plane-site. People can go there, or they could just Google your name and the page should come up, right?
Yeah, if you just go to indiegogo.com and just type in Edward Doty or Fighting in Plain Sight, you'll be able to find the page.
Let's give the people listening at home some background on Torre himself, or at least what he presented himself as being originally. I saw a clip, I think it was on YouTube, a really, really good, really well-produced 7 or 8 minute clip. But if I'm recalling correctly, he said he was a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt who grew up in Brazil, and I think that he was taught by his father, who was supposedly an instructor. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, and this is what's so interesting about the story. Firstly, the short film that you're referring to, we did that for the International Documentary Challenge, which is sort of a speed filmmaking competition. That was back in February of 2013. We did that in 5 days. We wrote, we shot, we edited, and we exported it in less than 5 days. So keep that in mind when you're watching it, because that was what ultimately, after doing that in 5 days, that ultimately made me realize, okay, with the team that I've assembled, we can handle the feature. We can take this feature length and have it not be a problem.
A lot of that footage, though, must have dated back to prior to his conviction.
Well, a lot of that was, what was my raw footage from Life in the Cage. I shot a lot of stuff from Life in the Cage. I mean, I shot close to 40 hours for Life in the Cage, and and obviously Life in the Cage is just under an hour, so clearly I had a lot of stuff that I wasn't using. Raphael was a big part of that. In order to kind of properly frame Raphael's story and properly set that in context, I met Raphael the very first shoot I did in 1999. He was a corner man for this fighter named Kenny Torino, or Tenorio, I believe his name was. And he was friendly and he was nice. And, he told me that he had a jiu-jitsu MMA school near 29 Palms, which is kind of outside of Palm Springs. There's a Marine base there. So a lot of his students were Marines on the base. So the next time I saw him was at King of the Cage 2 in February of 2000. And when I saw him, he wasn't cornering anybody. He was writing for, at the time, the main news source for the MMA fan base, which was the Abu Dhabi website. It was adcombat.com. It was the news aggregate for the Abu Dhabi Fight Club. For basically the ADCC championships. So he was writing for them, doing fighter interviews, and when I saw him, he remembered me, and he was very friendly, and I said, hey, do you mind, while you're interviewing guys, if I just film, because I could use it as sound bites and just good B-roll, and he said, sure. And we struck up a friendship, and the story, I could always rely on him for a clean, concise sound bite. He could speak very articulately. He knew, he was just a wealth of information, not just about MMA, but about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and how the sport emigrated, from Brazil up to here. So he was very good at explaining those things. And as he explained it to me at the time, his father was a Jiu-Jitsu black belt and trained him in karate. And, he sure made it sound like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I heard that Raphael had competed in the 1998 Abu Dhabi grappling championships. And he ended up losing the first round to somebody, but to even fight in Abu Dhabi is a perk in and of itself. So certainly, nobody would ever besmirch the reputation of somebody who fought in Abu Dhabi. So that's how he sort of presented himself, was that he was a journalist, he was a teacher, and he also, had a background in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And he looked the part. He walked the walk, and he sounded very convincing, and he was always very friendly with other people. Like, Rico Rodriguez, I sort of knew through the Machados, and Rico was fighting on that card, and him and Rico seemed to know each other and were very friendly. And so everybody I knew, Raphael already knew. Everybody that I knew about, Raphael already knew about. So because he was so knowledgeable, you trusted sort of the rest of his story.
Mm-hmm. He claimed to be retired from fighting and undefeated during his career. Is that correct?
Yeah, but again, contextually, everybody did. If you watch the first Extreme Fightings, there were guys stepping into the ring with records of 38-0 and 502, and the records were a bit padded, and there was sort of an idea that because a lot of the fights, especially back in the day, were unsanctioned, back of gym type stuff, people could count that.
Right.
So that was the operating assumption, is that he was 18-0 in the same way that Hickson was 500-0.
Right.
Because depending on how you counted it. So, you heard that, and the operating assumption I had was, these are probably back to the gym fights or, underground fights, which were not uncommon. When I interviewed Dan Caldwell from Tap Out, he tells this great story of, again, the underground days of going to go see fights. There was a U-Haul in Compton where they would have fights. And if you wanted to go see the fights, you went up to the U-Haul like you were going to rent a van, and you said and you said whatever the password was. You paid $45, and they wrote it down on a sheet of paper, and they said, okay, this way, and they had this warehouse where they literally set up a cage. So when you're thinking 18-0, you're thinking in the context of that.
Yeah, because you know, I'm sure a lot of people just took his word for it over the years. You know, and as you mentioned, there were with a lot of guys, there probably wasn't a great amount of detail provided as far as what events they fought and so on and so forth. So, I do know he was originally known in the MMA community for his so-called Gonzo interviews, where he would travel to events and ask fighters different questions, some of which, you know, had an irreverent theme or tone.
Yeah.
I think I recall him asking about anal sex a lot, and Heath Herring's memorable answer that he liked giving it but didn't enjoy receiving it so much.
Yeah, no, I mean, not just that, but, like, I remember when he was – when I first met him and when I was first interacting with him, it wasn't so much that. When I think of Rafael's writing, I think of just the enthusiasm. He very much had this I don't want to say nerdy or fanboyish, but he had a level of enthusiasm that was very infectious. So, you know, he wasn't the best writer in the sense of his command of grammar and diction, but there was an unbridled love that he had in his articles that, you know, it did have a sort of a way of making you feel like you were there. And I think the Gonzo stuff was born out of that, but honestly, I think his best stuff was the series he had called Lessons in Humility, where he, you know, he would go train with somebody, and the whole premise was, look, I'm a black belt, and I recognize I'm not as good as some of these other guys, so I'm going to go roll with Mark Kerr, or I'm going to roll with Sakuraba, and they're going to kick my butt, and I'm going to write about it. And it was a good series. It was, he had some insight into, you know, how these guys were different, how they performed different. So that when I think of his writing, I think of that. I think if you look on, you know, Google Archive or the Wayback Machine, you can bring up some of his older articles, and you can see that love and that enthusiasm come through.
Am I right in saying that he actually helped introduce you to people within the community and gain access to subjects for filming?
Absolutely. And yeah, I say it in my short, you know, that he being around him legitimized me to a degree. You know, there's a few guys that were really instrumental in helping me out and sort of providing me with access. Eddie Millis, the operator of the Shark Tank in, you know, Rancho Cucamonga, they used to go train at the Lions Den. They'd load up their car, drive down to San Diego, and Ken and Vernon and Guy Mesger and Alex Andrade, they'd spar with those guys. So I got to go to the Lions Den, which for me, as, you know, someone who literally grew up watching Ken Shamrock, that was a dream. Charles from Tap Out, I considered him a great friend. He, you know, I used to go over to his house, and he used to show me all these crazy unsanctioned videos, like from the Mark Hall's Cobra Challenge and you know, one of the 7 million fights that Shannon, what's her name?
Shannon Rich
fought. He used to show me, like, his comic book art that he would draw, because he always wanted to do, like, a Tap Out comic. That was, like, his dream. He was instrumental in vouching for me. And Rafael was one of those guys. Rafael was one of those guys who, you know, I think he introduced me to Ken properly at Kingly Cage 2 when I interviewed Ken. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, yeah, I certainly, in spite of everything that's happened, I would never try to diminish that. He absolutely, I don't think I could have made Life in Cage without his help.
How much time would you say that you actually spent with Tori in person, and how much footage does that translate to in raw terms?
You know, I think if you edit it all together, I think I've got probably 2 nonstop hours of him. But that's including B-roll of him talking to people. That's B-roll of him interviewing. That's direct interviews with him. In terms of the time spent not filming, I mean, our friendship was like a lot of, you know, friendships with people in the MMA scene. When everybody lives 5 hours apart from one another, you know, it's you know, we talked on the phone a few times. He interviewed me for his own website at one point. We fell out of touch when I was finishing Life in the Cage, because at that point, I didn't know this at the time, but at that point, him and his wife at the time were divorcing for reasons, you know, we'll go into in the film a little bit. But because of that, you know, 2003 was the first time where I asked, hey, whatever happened to Rafael? Because no one ever hears or talks from him. And, you know, I haven't heard from him. And the last time I tried to call him, his son answered and said, yeah, he doesn't live here anymore, and just hung up. So I figured something was going on, and you know, I just didn't know exactly what. But during that time, during those 2 years, from like 99 to 2001, you know, I'd see him at every event. Every event I went to, I would see him at. And half the jiu-jitsu tournaments I would go to, I would see him at. He was always around, and he was sort of one of those luminaries. King of the Cage used to do this thing where, in between fights, kind of like at the halfway point, Bruce Buffer, who would do the announcing for King of the Cage, would get on the mic and say, you know, we have a number of mixed martial arts celebrities in the audience tonight. Let's give them a round of applause. And he would call out Ken Shamrock and Mark Kerr and whoever else. And then, you know, and Raphael's name would get mentioned as well, and he got his share of applause too. So, you know, that was our friendship was definitely around that context of, you know, I'll see you at the next event. But he was at every event, so I always saw him.
During that time, did you ever become suspicious about his claims in terms of his skill and martial arts training?
It did occur to me that, you know, I've never actually seen him roll.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of put that away. And then there was one point where I remember, like, somebody, and it may have been Eddie Bravo, it may have been somebody else, but somebody clarified to me, like, on kind of on the downloads, like, yeah, his dad is a black belt in jiu-jitsu, and he's a black belt in jiu-jitsu, but it's Japanese jiu-jitsu, it's not part of the Brazilian jiu-jitsu lineage, and he's had to adapt it to kind of like an MMA standpoint. And this is, again, this is sort of like, there were a lot of these guys who trained in traditional Japanese jiu-jitsu, like small circle jiu-jitsu or, you know, some of these other Japanese jiu-jitsu styles. And then once BJJ came on the scene, they would try to repurpose it and focus more on Nate Waza, you know, the mat work. But it wasn't quite the same. You know what I mean? Just like judo is not quite Brazilian jiu-jitsu on the ground, Japanese jiu-jitsu certainly is not Brazilian jiu-jitsu on the ground. And so somebody had told me that, so I just kind of like, oh, okay, that makes sense, you know. But again, you know, his series was Lessons in Humility, so he wasn't, you know, I felt like that was his attempt to sort of draw attention to this. But it wasn't until 2001 when he was going to fight in King of the Cage himself, like King of the Cage 7.
Right.
And at the time, Life in Cage was done, but I was flat broke. I was a college student. I had nothing. And Bud Bressman threw me a bone, and he's like, yeah, just go out and film fighter packages. And I remember I said, who do you want me to film, like, you know, fighter profiles for? And he gave me the list of the people in the main event. And I said, well, you know, Raphael's fighting your card, and he's not main event, but it's a cool story. It's like a grudge match, and that might be cool. He's like, yeah, go ahead and film him too. So I went to Chris Brennan's school, Next Generation, out in Irvine. Not Irvine, I'm sorry. It was Inland Empire somewhere. It was out in that San Bernardino region. And I went and him and Gerald Trebent were there, and I started filming them. And I just kind of was watching him do his thing, you know, just like hitting pads, shadow boxing. And when he threw a right hook,
uh-huh.
or no, I'm sorry, left hook. It was just a 1-2-3 combo, jab, cross, left hook. His left hook was real funky. Real funky. And I'm not a master fighter myself. You know, I've done jiu-jitsu tournaments, I fought in the Shotokan, but I'm not a badass, nor do I claim to be. But intellectually, I understand good technique. Intellectually, I understand good form. I know proper posture. And when he threw his left hook, I'm like, that ain't it. That is not the left hook of a dude who knows how to fight. And he started doing, like, his kicking far more resembled, like, traditional karate than, like, and even, like, taekwondo than certainly Muay Thai. And then we started doing stuff on the ground. It felt very seminar-ish. It felt very, like, you know, it wasn't, right. like, born out of someone who spent a lot of time on the mat and had, like, a natural flow of events. It's like, I learned this, and now I'm going to demonstrate what I learned. That it felt like that to me. But when I'm operating camera and I'm filming, my mind is elsewhere. But sort of in this stream of consciousness, in the back of my mind, I'm recognizing that you know, this isn't just like a slight exaggeration of his skills. This is something more than that, you know? So that was like the first time a red flag like actually went up, for me at least.
You know, he also claimed to be an ex-Navy SEAL or something like that, then I got to tell you, it's one of the great ironies for me that fans of No Holds Barred consider themselves to be better and more realistically minded than traditional martial arts practitioners, yet at the time, so many frauds and liars have been able to thrive within the community. In the early days of the sport, I feel like there was an atmosphere of boasting and one-upmanship in early MMA, and it always seemed to me that some of the fighters who were drawn to the sport were either compulsive attention seekers or desperately insecure people who felt the need for validation.
Well, you know, I think, and again, context is everything, and I think what's really important to understand when I started training martial arts literally in 1993, the year that the UFC came out, and I was doing Kung Fu. And I stuck with it, but I ended up becoming a black sash in Kung Fu, and then I transitioned to Jeet Kune Do, and then from there to Muay Thai and Jiu-Jitsu. But there's an atmosphere of amongst the traditional martial artists of, you know, oh, crap, we can't lie to ourselves anymore. And the way a lot of people reacted to this, you know, once the UFC came out and sort of showed reality, there were two very popular reactions. There were three very popular reactions. One of them was sort of my approach, which was, okay, clearly what I've learned will not prepare me for this, so I need to start learning what they're doing. The other reaction was, well, that's not a real fight, and my art would still work in a real fight. Or the third reaction is, my art is fully capable of that, of being that. So, like, all of my katas have application on the ground, or if I'm as good in Japanese jiu-jitsu, that's a direct translation of Brazilian jiu-jitsu. So, and you see that to this day, I think. You see, you know, you can't drive past a Taekwondo school that doesn't have Brazilian jiu-jitsu sign hanging from it as well. You can't drive past a karate school that also has now MMA etched on it. They're not teaching anything different. They're just relabeling what it is they do. And I think you saw a little bit of that with Rafael. And I think you saw, like, in my opinion, this is just me speculating at this point, I think when you dedicate your life towards an art and then overnight it suddenly proved irrelevant, I think that can really mess with a lot of people. And I think that's, you can either dust yourself off psychologically or, you know, you can cope with it in any number of ways. And I think what Rafael did was sort of cope with that. I think, especially back in the day where it's like, if you took traditional martial arts, people would say, oh, I can't show you my art because I would hurt you. You know, I can't do what I would actually do in a fight because I just can't control it, man. Like, that was a popular reaction born out of ninja movies and kung fu movies, you know. That was what people thought martial arts was. And I think out of, you know, the cold splash of water that UFC 1 was, I think some people reacted to that very poorly. And some people tried to, in many ways, lie to themselves in order to cope with the fact that they dedicated their lives to something that doesn't do what it was advertised to do. And that's my opinion, at least. That's just sort of what I saw in Rafael.
Yeah, and a lot of these guys, you know, came from broken homes, directionless former high school jocks, individuals with criminal backgrounds, and, you know, aggressive types, and so on and so forth. So basically, you know, anyone who goes and hangs out at an MMA show will see that there are a hell of a lot of weirdos there who are identifiable just by sight alone. And it figures that some of those weirdos would also lie about themselves and their backgrounds, and that a few of them would be somewhat successful in doing so. And in terms of Rafael, he really, I think, is the king of modern martial arts frauds in terms of the way his story played out. And so I can understand why you would want to tell that story, given that you already had footage of him, which basically even more interesting and relevant over time. So, yeah, he basically was interviewing fighters for different sites. I know he was a moderator at the Underground. And,
yeah, he was a mod there, amongst other places too. I think he was definitely on the UG, and I think he was. I mean, and people forget. I mean, back in the day, the UG was the Underground Forum was our lifeline. There would not have been a sport if not for that forum. And I cannot give Kirik and all those other guys enough props because they kept the sport alive, straight up. Them, Jeff Sherwood at Sherdog, and Jeff and I just talked the other day actually, the sport stands on the backs of those dudes, straight up. And, that's not to take anything away from what Dana White and the Fertittas have done. I obviously, they have made the sport what it is now, but, you know, if they're the physical therapy, the Underground and Jeff Sherwood was the life support, because it was straight up on life support for a very long time.
Yeah, Kirik has done a great job, and he's had some really interesting choices for moderators over the years. Now, he's chosen some weird people over the years, which goes back to what I was saying about MMA fans and whatnot. But Ed, was it only after Rafael decided he was going to have a comeback fight that questions about him started to be raised?
Well, I mean, I think I was one of the last people to really figure it out, to be honest with you. I tend to give people the benefit of the doubt and always try to see the best in people. But in retrospect, you know, during sort of like the end of my time being friends with them, where I just assumed everything was true, other people were starting to figure it out. Other people were starting to put two and two together. And it was, you know, in retrospect, conversations I've had with other people, they've said, yeah, we kind of figured it out right away. My buddy Turi Altavia, who promotes U of MMA, and you know, he and I were talking the other day, and he said, because he trains the Machados as well, and he always thought it was weird that Rafael would come by and say hi and watch, but he would never get on the mat. And he just always thought, like, why wouldn't a black belt get on the mat and show you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's the thing about our culture, is that if you've learned anything, the instinct is to share. The instinct is to try to help. The instinct is to try to be generous with your time. We see it a million times over at every school. You know, somebody drops in, hey, they're going to show us some things today. You know, Karen Parisian's here today. He's going to show us one of his light blocks. You know, just whatever. Like, whoever's here is going to help. And Rafael did not have the reputation for doing that. He would come by, say hi, chat, be friendly, be cool, but he would never roll. And from that, it was, you know, people, not myself, I cannot take credit for it, people would start to kind of put two and two together. So
Tori's comeback fight took place at King of the Cage event, and he reportedly took on either a friend or former student of his and what was supposed to be a grudge match. And the fight looked really, really bad, sloppily contested. And and I saw some of this last night with his opponent tapping out to a knee bar, which in no way appeared to be torquing the leg.
Right. I mean, I got to say, he picked the perfect night to allegedly throw a fight, because that was the infamous King of the Cage 7 Wet and Wild, where it, out of nowhere, Palm Springs, where it never rains, Palm Springs got rain. And they set up this tarp, but it was porous and it was flat. So, I mean, what ended up happening, it essentially was a giant coffee filter over the cage. And they could not keep the water out. And this was a huge event, because they had Guy Mezger fighting Alexander Otsuka on the card. They had, they had a lot of people from Pride fighting. And then, but in between, people were slipping all over the place. You can throw, I mean, Eves Edwards fought the late Jeremy, shoot, I'm forgetting his name, but Eves Edwards fought on that card. Like, so many people fought on that card, but everybody was slipping around, everybody was sliding. Rafael, the first takedown that Rafael succumbs to, I mean, it looks like a legitimate flip. So, I mean, that whole night was just chaotic to begin with. But, yeah, I mean, the thing that I noticed, the big thing that stood out to me was that he was landing these giant knees from side control, these giant Mark Kerr-style knees to the body of this dude, who was, I mean, who outweighed him by 100 pounds. Big Joe was his name. Big Joe was a gigantic Samoan fellow. And Rafael was landing these knees, and I was backstage watching the monitor for the first part of it, and then I kind of made my way cage side. I wasn't supposed to be there, but I made my way cage side. And I made it in time. I'll never forget this. I kind of squared myself and sat down as he started throwing those knees.
Mm-hmm.
And as he did that, I visibly saw the knees hit the mat. Like, the knees were hitting the mat. I think one of them actually hit his side. But I'm like, trying to give him the benefit of the doubt, I thought, oh, well, he's just missing and he's slipping and he's hitting the thing. But then I remember seeing Joe acting like he was hurting from it. So it was really bizarre. And then, you know, the knee bar, again, you see the knee bar, and it doesn't fully extend. And I remember, like, at this point, I'm actively trying to convince myself that it's real. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, he's a big dude. He probably doesn't stretch a lot. It's probably just a flexibility issue where he's just, like, hyperextending his, you know, his hamstring or something. And it's a pain tap, you know, because some inflexible dudes will do that. But then I remember backstage going there and then seeing Joe, and he was acting really angry. He was, oh man, I can't believe I lost, yelling. And I remember he knocked over like a box or something, and then like 20 minutes later, he was smiling. Like, his entire crew was around him, and he was happy, and, like, nothing had happened. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's like, I don't know. I'm not a fighter. I don't claim to be one. But I fought in the 96 Team USA Shotokan, and I got knocked out in the first round, and I sobbed for, like, 20 minutes afterwards. Like, losing sucks. If you care at all, losing sucks. And it's not something you just get over that quickly. If you really care, and especially for the grudge match with the dude you hate, you don't react that way if you actively care. So at the end of the night, I was like, I remember driving home, and I'm like, something ain't right. Like, you know, I just remember, like I'm not exactly sure, but I didn't, the last thing I wanted to do was, like, falsely, you know, like, not just accuse, but think the wrong thing of somebody. So.
So what happened after the fight? My understanding is that he came out and admitted that he had an exaggerated ground skill set, instead claiming he was a black belt in Tori Jiu-Jitsu rather than BJJ.
Yeah.
You know, what happened after that?
So he claimed that, and I think people were willing to sort of look past that to a degree, because, you know, he was still writing. But then the big thing, the big sea change for me was that all of a sudden he just out of nowhere quit writing for Abu Dhabi. And Abu Dhabi, I mean, you know, Abu Dhabi was Kid Peligro, it was Kip Kolar, it was, like, legit dudes, and for Rafael to leave angrily, it was just sort of bizarre. And then for, you know, for them to, and then he started up his own website that he overhyped. He's like, this is going to be the best, going to be, you know, it's called Fight Fan News. The interface was really kind of crappy, and, like, there wasn't enough content, and it was, at this point, he was fully invested in those Gonzo interviews. So, in many ways, he sort of discredited himself just on the work he was putting out. I think a lot of people would have been willing to forgive him or look past some of that other stuff if he was still providing, if he was still writing great articles and providing great content. But it wasn't the same. You know, it's like, it's almost like his public life was starting to sort of spiral in many of the same ways that his private life was.
Yeah, because, right, he kind of withdrew himself from being a public figure. Describe your reaction to the moment when you heard for sure that he had lied to you, or when you knew for sure that he lied to you and everybody else. What went through your mind?
It's a bit complicated, because the moment I heard he had lied was also the same moment I heard that he was suspected in killing this guy, Brad Richardson. So for me, I'll never forget it. You know, I'll try carefully here too, because, there's some people who don't want their name associated with this. But I was in the car with a very good friend of mine who knew Rafael very well. And, he told me everything, and, not just everything. He told me stories about Rafael dating back to, you know, prior to Rafael moving down here. And basically in one car ride, in the span of half an hour, I learned that Rafael not only was not a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt, he was a karate black belt who had learned some jiu-jitsu. He had basically lied his way. I don't know how he got into Abu Dhabi, but he had basically deceived his way into Abu Dhabi. And these are undisputed, because these are things Rafael would later testify under oath to lying about. So I'm not making allegations here. These are all things Rafael admitted to. Rafael, you know, he completely fabricated that. He was not born Rafael Torre. His birth name was Ralph Bartle. He legally changed his name to Rafael Torre prior to moving to California. And, you know, his father was not from Brazil. I think his father had, like, I could be wrong here, but Argentinian or Ecuadorian descent, but he was from Oregon. So, you know, his nationality was made up. He was not 17-0 in any verifiable underground fight. And on top of that, you know, sometime in 2001, he began a relationship with a woman who you can find that out online. I'm not going to say her name here for a few reasons. He became involved with a woman. He was friends with this woman's husband. They had, you know, according to his story, they had begun an affair. And then at this point, I'll just say what Rafael has been convicted of. Rafael has been convicted of, at one point, you know, there was an altercation at Rafael's school, and as the prosecution claimed and as a jury of his peers convicted him on, Rafael got this guy in a rear naked choke and held it for long enough to kill him, dump his body in the back of a truck, and left it in a Safeway parking lot. And it took a while. It took a while to put the case together. It took about 2 years, 2 to 3 years for them to actually get the evidence necessary. But, you know, Gerald Strebent, who is a friend of mine, a former teammate of mine at 10th Planet, Gerald was the witness, and Gerald has quite a bit to say that he testified to. I learned pretty much all of this in the span of one conversation. When I learned this, Raphael had not been brought up on charges yet because the DA was still assembling the case. But I remember at that time, you know, my friend said, "I have his number if you want to call him," kind of half jokingly. And I said, "I'm good. I'm, you know," because it's not that I didn't want to believe the best in my friend. It's that when all of my other friends who I trust, you know, with my life pretty much, who I know are legit, who I know haven't lied about anything, when they're all in agreement on the same story, it becomes very clear who you believe. So it was just a matter of time. And then I remember hearing, yeah, they finally arrested him. I'm like, yep, it's going down. And then three of my friends were called to testify against him.
Gerald Strebent testified that Tory offered him $10,000 to kill Richards. And he's a friend of the show, Gerald.
Gerald is a Marine Corps sniper and a sniper instructor. And as Gerald says, and as I completely believe 100%, Gerald can tell it better than I can. I could not get a hold of Gerald when I made the short, but Gerald is obviously a very huge part of the feature film going forward of the documentary. But as Gerald talks about, you know, Raphael said, you know, I think, you know, things would go so much smoother for Angelina if Brian wasn't around. And when Gerald rightly said, "That's effing crazy," Raphael tried to play it off like, "Yeah, of course, I'm just joking." But then when Brian actually turned up dead, and Raphael contacted Gerald and said, "You know, I guess Brian had a gun on him. That was his gun." And Gerald, he told Gerald, like, "I gotta get rid of this. I need you to get rid of it for me." And Gerald flatly refused. But that's all part of the case. That's all, you know. I'm hesitant to talk too much about the details of it for a few different reasons. But one of the big reasons is because, you know, this is part of the process of the feature film we're trying to make. We're trying to go into detail. And I want to make it clear now. I've sent a letter off to Raphael, and my hope is that he would be willing to talk about some of the stuff, you know, on camera. I'm more than happy to hear his side of it, and I'm more than happy to hear his, not just of the murder, but I just of all the events leading up to it, because, you know, as Dan said, he was kind of an integral part of the scene for a while. And, you know, my appeal to Raphael is, you know, let's hear it from your side. Let's see what you have to say. I don't think it's going to change anything. I don't think you're going to change anybody's opinion. But, you know, it's I'm not telling Raphael Torrey's story. I'm telling the story of all the events around Raphael, you know, if that makes any sense. And I'm telling the story of the sport at this time looking inward on the events of this, of his involvement in the sport. It's almost like, you know, you hear filmmakers say, like, I'm looking at this event through this character's eyes. I want to invert that. I want to look at this character through this whole era's eyes. If this time period has a sensibility, I want to see the time period's perspective on Raphael in those few years. That's the story I'm interested in telling. It's easy to just tell a story and say, like, oh, he's this and he's this monster. And certainly if you ask the family of the victim, they would rightfully tell you that. But I'm interested in telling this whole story. And I want to be completely fair to certainly to the victim's family, to the family of Brian Richards. You know, we're my hope is I can talk to them pretty soon. I definitely want their involvement, and certainly want to do right by them first and foremost. But you know, it's easy to just do a hit piece. I'm not interested in doing that. I want to know more. There's more to the story, and I want to know about it.
Well, you're right, and we're coming up on a minute here left to go, and there's so much more that I have to ask you about regarding Gerald Streben, regarding the alleged life insurance policy that was taken out.
So much
that hopefully we can have you on in the future. Ed,
sure.
Give people any place on the internet where they could check out your work or any relevant place that you want people to go to.
Sure. Primarily, if you go to Facebook, facebook.com/fightinginplainsight, you'll have the film's Facebook page. If you go to Indiegogo, indiegogo.com, and then just type in Fighting in Plain Sight, you'll be able to find our campaign, certainly. If you go to YouTube.com, I'm pulling up the URL right now. If you go to YouTube.com and look Fighting in Plain Sight, you'll have access to the 7-minute short. If you go to and you'll be able to access my page there. There's not a lot of other content on there. I primarily use that to deliver material to clients. And then if you go to Twitter, it's twitter.com/FIPS movie. Follow us on Twitter. And then my personal Twitter is twitter.com/LuckyBestWash. That's a Simpsons reference, but that's my personal one, and I'm always hyping stuff up. And then on YouTube, my YouTube channel is youtube.com/user/laserfistmedia. That is my company's name. So,
well, listen, Ed Doty, thank you for coming on Carson's Corner. We got to do this again. Very, very good, informative interview. And thank you for your great work.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the time having me on.
Take care, Ed.
You take care.
All right, that wraps it up for this edition of Carson's Corner. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.